Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have as our guest today, Mike Whalen. Mike is an author, podcaster, Facebook Live hoster, really a lot of things technologically related and a very interesting guy. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, guys. Yes, I am very bored and I'm on very many social platforms because it's COVID and I'm lonely and you guys talk to me, please.
Well, just so folks have a chance to get to know you, I mean, for one thing, I'll just throw it out of the gate. You are a Texas licensed attorney and you practiced for some time, you've practiced in a few settings, but was most of your time down in Rockport or where all did you practice?
Yeah, so I started out in Austin. I actually met Todd during law school and I went to the University of Texas at Austin and I practiced there for a little while. I partnered with a friend there for a while. I moved down to Rockport, which is a rural context. And that last spot really drove a lot of the truths that came out in the book, Lawyer Forward, that I wrote about that experience of trying to get out of the churn of that daily grind of you're only worth your next hour or your next case. And so in solo and small practice, I really experienced the difference between building assets, something to last, something that didn't need me, versus what's really happening for most solos, where you're just in this constant grind of cash flow obsession. And that was sort of the core of the book. So my practice was in mostly family law in different parts of Texas during the, 8 years or so that I practiced.
And you're dedicating yourself full time now to the other pursuits that we've kind of touched on. Is that right?
That is right, which my wife thinks is hilariously ill-informed. Despite what people say, it's pretty easy to make money as an attorney. You just get to tell people this is what I charge and get over it. When you're doing something a little more esoteric like writing and commentating, it's a little harder to explain to people why they should do what you say. So we are living on this now. We live in Kansas City now. I've officially gone inactive as an attorney. I got a new card from the state bar. It was gold and it said inactive on the bottom. And my kids thought it was hilarious that they sent me a new card to say, you're not even lawyering, dummy. So here's a card. So I'm officially inactive now.
Well, to some people, you've kind of entered nirvana then. You know, a lot of folks think after they've practiced for a while, they're like, oh, why am I doing this? Maybe I can figure out something else to do and actually use my law license, which of course you've got the benefit of your experience as a lawyer that I think colors your work in many, many ways. So that's
another buddy that I met during law school, Jordan, his advice to me was don't do a practice area that involves someone crying in your office. So of course I did family law and that is a context I'm glad to be out of now. That is God's work. Good on you people who are dealing with that stuff, but I just couldn't do it anymore.
I know Dirk and that sounds exactly like something he would say. That's great. So we're going to talk a lot about the book because it's fascinating. And I think there are some lessons for both trial lawyers and appellate lawyers in there. But I do want to mention before we get into that too deeply that you actually have hosted a conference here in Austin and did that for several years. And you've also recently started a podcast and both of those bear the name also Lawyer Forward, right?
Yeah, that's right. The Lawyer Forward Conference, we did that for 5 years live in Austin. And then, of course, this last year did it virtually. So I think in the future, it might well be virtual for a while. It's difficult to do live conference, obviously, these days. But in general, to get lawyers to come and step out of their world for 3 days is really difficult. And the purpose of Lawyer Forward, whether it's the book or the conference or the podcast, is to change the culture and just get people to think differently about the way they do things. And so I worry with a few days of conference that people will show up, they'll listen for a while, tell themselves they check the innovation bubble and then go back home and do the exact same thing. So the advantage of things like virtual conferences and podcasts is you can stay in people's mind for a longer amount of time. So I think we're probably going to stick that way.
And now everybody's familiar with Zoom platforms and webinar platforms and things in a way that 6 months ago, nobody was really.
That's right. So, all right, let's dive in then to, you touched upon this a little already, but I want to dive into your experience that led you to write the book, because if I've read it, I've marked it up like crazy. There's a lot of aha moments in it for me. Maybe I'll share one or two of those during the show today, but I guess I'll start with what I thought was a very interesting story. And if you haven't read the book or listened to Mike's podcast, I'll say he's a gifted storyteller. That's one of his ways that he teaches. And so the story that you led with about how the legal factory system got started was really interesting, and how the way I read it was that this was the origin of the law firm, you know, what we think of now as the big law firm model, the cravath model with associates and so forth. But tell us, touch on that, but also just tell us kind of what the driver was for you writing this book that makes us think about how to do things differently.
Yeah. So briefly, that story, the context in the background of the book is that I didn't go to law school until I was 30. And I had worked in logistics already for almost a decade before that. I got my first job in trucking when I was really young because I was dating a girl who looked like Drew Barrymore and for some reason purposely tried to talk like Drew Barrymore, which is the most annoying thing about Drew Barrymore. It was the weirdest thing. Anyway, so her dad owned a trucking company. I got his job. And so I worked in that industry for about 10 years and it just wasn't the right spot for me. And so I went back to law school, as you do when you don't know what you want to do. And I came out, and Todd, you saw this when I was in law school, I had some understanding of what it's like to run a business, to be part of business. And the students who were at Texas did not have that background. And so I created, I think maybe in my second year of law school, a future solo small firm club with the idea that, hey guys, it's 2008. It was a disaster. And you guys are all going to have to be at some point in your life solo. 50% of lawyers are currently solo, which means more than that are solo over the course of their life. And so you need to learn some of these skills. This needs to be part of the legal education. And it wasn't at UT at all. And so I created this group. I started teaching these things. And through that and through the conference, as an aside, nobody showed up at these things during law school because they all assumed they were going to get big firm jobs, but they all called me afterwards. So all of that stuff just kept piling up. And I found myself talking about these things so much that it just was fun. And so I went back and tried to figure out, why do solo and small practices specifically work the way we do? And that led me to why big firms operate the way they do, and back to the story of how Paul Cravath came up with what we now know as the system, the capital S system. And in short, in this book called Last Days of Night, it tells this really interesting story of the fight between George Westinghouse and Thomas Edison over the incandescent light bulb. And Edison, he was a jerk, first of all. I mean, just a terrible character in so many ways, but we laud him for coming. One of his jerky things that he did was he put these employees in a warehouse, and basically they all worked on the same problem, nameless, faceless cogs. They would raise their hand and say, I got it. And then Edison would go slap his brand on it and sell it. And it was this idea factory model. It wasn't like a chain model, like the Ford model. That's the way Westinghouse's office worked. But Edison's model was, he was not an inventor. He had an invention factory. He had a bunch of smart people in a room churning over work, raising their hand, and then losing the asset. And instead of Cravath walking in and saying, well, this is a nightmare and looks awful for all employees, he said, I'm going to do the same thing. Now, to Cravath's credit, he added a lot of very human touches to it. He tried to make it so it was based on the education of the associates, but it was designed for the churn. It was designed for this just mulling over the same thing over time. And this was amplified when law switched to hourly billing. That wasn't true before that time period. We were not doing hourly billing before that. But between Cravath adding this system, what Langdell was doing at Harvard with legal education, it just created this system where we were doing analytic thinking, breaking things down, no big picture thinking, and churning over hours. And I'm not the first to say that this is disastrous at all. It's really bad for lawyers. We have a lot of data about how bad this is for lawyers. Clients aren't happy. The economics of it don't really work very well. They work in the short term, but not in the long term. I'm not the person to raise these flags. My question was, in the book, how do we fix it? How do we use what I learned from my supply chain background before law school to create some new way to work? That's essentially what the book is a journey of me trying to figure out how my two worlds make me an asset rather than a piece that doesn't fit.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, Litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
You've mentioned the concept of the churn a few times, and I think that's really the central theme of the book is we as lawyers, most of us, the ones that at least bill by the hour, we're almost stuck in this model of we know how to work, we know how to get paid, and we do what's in front of us today, but we're only as good as the next hour or the next 8 hours that we can bill. And so one thing that you advance in this book is how to change the system. And this system is slow to change, but how to change the system so that you're getting away from only being as good as your next hour. And you mentioned, and I want to talk about this some more in a bit, you mentioned the idea of building assets as a way to be profitable, to make money as a lawyer with a couple of different models. And those are fascinating to me. But the one thing that you talked about too a lot is this concept of silos. It seems like that's where the associates in the cravath model are really in any firm and really any lawyer to a certain degree. It's true that we as a profession do tend to get siloed and only think about and deal with what's basically within arm's reach and what our immediate problems are. I've observed this certainly in myself and in many other lawyers, is it's notoriously hard for people to get our attention or to encourage us effectively to change because we're so used to being in our own bubble or silo.
Right. But what's interesting about that research is that silos are not bad. In fact, they're really good. If you're properly structured and properly connected, then silos are great. There's a book called Tribal Leadership, for example, that talks about how this works in offices and how instead of breaking down those clusters of 20 to 150 people who just naturally silo, it's part of this human condition, instead of trying to break those up, which rarely works, I'd share the story of Sony and how that was a total disaster versus Apple, who broke it up by Steve Jobs just sort of being an autocratic dictator. There's a lot of bad things with trying to break down these silos. What the research shows, there's a book called Friend of a Friend that I reference a lot, is that being in a silo that's properly structured is very productive. I share the example of Venetian glassblowers and how being moved to a silo is great for them. Issue is that we're not connecting those silos very well. And when I think about big firms, and Jody, you know more about this context than I do, one of the big problems with the larger firms is the lack of coordination between the silos. It's that lack of connection between, you see this floor does this practice area and this floor does this practice area and this floor is the leadership, and they don't really connect with each other. And this is true as you add offices, you start to separate more and more and there's not connection. What the network science shows is that the silos are great, but leadership really needs to figure out how to connect these people. It's obviously different in the solo small firm context, but in the big firm context, you're seeing it as well.
I think that's right. And part of the issue, I think overall in big firms, is the people that lead big firms are lawyers that grew up in big firms for the most part. And so to your point that you were talking about earlier, these are people who went to law school 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, didn't get the business side training of it. And maybe you've had some that you've picked up along the way, but basically you've learned your entire career in the big firm model. Now you're managing the big firm model. So when someone comes in and says, hey, let's break this up and change this and break up the chains and make some more connections, there's just necessarily pushback on that because it's uncomfortable. It's scary. And these people have been very successful in this system.
Yeah. You're also rich.
Right. Well, there's that too.
As Richard Susskind says all the time, it's hard to tell a room full of millionaires that they're doing something wrong. And that's true. The issue is this goes beyond law, right? This question of how to connect people appropriately. There's a really good book called Counterproductive by Melissa Gregg. And the line in it, it's so brilliant. She says, instead of creating environments where you're thinking of the hour, making people maximized in their work spot, instead what you're doing is cultivating atmospheres where people can succeed. I love that idea of cultivating atmospheres. As the world becomes more complex, including work contexts, we can't control every step. If 2020 has taught us anything, it's that we have no freaking control over anything. And so what we're trying to do is cultivate these atmospheres where the outcomes we want are more likely. For large firms, cultivating that atmosphere means figuring out how to get people incentivized to do amazing work in their silo, in their bubble, cooperating with other people, collaborating in different ways, in multidisciplinary ways, and then figuring out how to connect those silos together for the good of the business. I was talking to a knowledge management person at a big firm recently. And I asked him, but how does the firm create new knowledge? Not how you look at assets from the past and the precedent and pull from all that. How do you create new knowledge? That's what clients want from you. Part of what they want is to know the rules and what happened before, but really they need new ideas, or they're just going to go to consultancies because consultancies build around new ideas. How do you create new ideas in law firms? And he said, well, everybody just does the work. They do that Edison thing where they raise a hand when they figure something out. I said, sorry, you don't have any kind of teams that are sitting in a room with post-it notes on the wall and putting their ideas up and bouncing around and brainstorming. And he said, lawyers would never do that. They don't like to share ideas, which, right? That was remarkable as a statement, probably totally true. Sharing crazy ideas is risky for lawyers. It makes us think we're dumb or wrong, and we only love the right answer. We're here because we know how to give the right answer. But just this idea that in a knowledge environment, which a law firm is a knowledge environment, we don't share knowledge. It's just baffling.
That's an interesting point. And you really do have to encourage people to step outside their comfort zones, because for so long, you know, knowing friends that work in a variety of practices, the answer to some of the questions is, why do we do it this way? Well, because we always have. And that's the end of the conversation. There's not a lot of room for innovation when the people who are making the decisions say, well, this is the way we've always done it and it's worked. So
it's labeled as the blank firm way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where this is the blank firm way, and that's, you conform, to paraphrase Rush, conform or be cast out, basically.
Well, and you end up really in sort of a standoff situation, because if one firm is reluctant to do it and they look at their peer firms and realize they're not doing it either, then to some people you'd see that as the opportunity. Let's be the thought leader on this and step out and try it. And for others, they say, well, wait, if nobody else is doing it, then it must not be a good idea because nobody else wants to venture out. So you end up in this weird sort of everyone's afraid to make the move kind of a deal.
The way we've done it for 100 years has made a ton of money and has really established law firms as powerhouses in different communities. That's degrading. We see that that's degrading. I think it's probably fair after 100 years to say, maybe it's time to think of a little different approach. And that's really what the book is about, is trying to nudge people to some systems that have existed for supply chain science has been around for 60, 70 years with big jumps in it with companies like Walmart or companies like Intel and how those jumps have happened. But this science has been around for a long time, not as long as the Cravath model, but it might be time to rethink a little bit.
What do you say, Mike? I can just hear someone in the back of my mind saying, but you're just commoditizing the law, and law is a noble profession. We shouldn't operate the same way as Walmart. We don't want law firm offices in Walmarts.
Yeah, I find it fascinating because law is commoditized now, right? If you talk to consumers, if you talk to clients, what we call legal work, I was on an interview yesterday and mentioned that we argue about the unauthorized practice of law, and even we don't know how to define that phrase. We don't know what the practice of law is. Clients definitely don't know what the practice of law is. They only know they need solutions to different problems. The best person to figure this out is going to get the work. Law firms historically have done more than just doing the forms, going to court, whatever that churn type practice is. We used to do a lot more than that. There was a lot of advisor function, counselor function, and that was all owned by law firms. What you see now is not that we aren't competitive with other law firms. We are. If you continue to do the churn model, you will be competitive with other law firms. That's not the threat to law firms right now. The threat is that we're losing to other solutions. We're losing non-legal work, so-called, to other solutions. And so as we continue in this model, we are already commoditized. The issue that I think is lawyers will say things like, but we add expertise. For example, expertise is different than knowledge, than just data. Other companies can show up with data and forms, but we have expertise, or we have the relationships. We're really great at building these connections and making the deals and all this stuff. If all of that is true, and the book is centered around those two functions, if all of that is true, great. Have your business built on systems that encourage that, not discourage it. Right now, the model discourages those two things that you're saying are making you special. And the end result is we're not actually that special. We're not building expertise. We're not honing on relationships.
So you're starting to sound a little bit like Susskind in the future of lawyers, and be on the lookout. You need to adapt or die, basically, which it's hard to really argue with that concept, but it seems like it would take a pretty brave leader of a larger firm to plug in to the idea of, well, we've always done it this way is not good enough anymore, because law firms are very large ships and they don't turn quickly. But it seems like in my practice situation, as a solo, I have the ability to turn and I'm agile and I can move move in any direction I want. And it's kind of fun to be able to reject conventional wisdom just because I'm like, I'm not going to do it just because it's always been done this way. But it seems like the larger firms, we have seen, I suppose, some strides. Law firms are starting to recognize that we do have to consider the business models. You're seeing CFOs and CEOs being appointed in law firms. It seems like there's been some change, but your book is really, I think, geared toward the solo and small firm practitioner primarily, but the ideas certainly could be implemented.
I would point out, although that is true, that a solo can be agile in a similar way, we're not part of the same system that Jody is in a big firm, but we're part of a system as well. And it's all influenced by culture. The courts operate the way that they operate, and we don't have a lot of control over that. Bars and regulators operate the way they do. Law schools operate the way they do. And although I am personally agile as a solo or small firm owner, I'm only agile within the constraints that are put around me. And so really, I think that the argument in the book is that we need a much larger system change, not just here's what to do in your solo small firm practice, but I think the change is going to come from the demand of lawyers, right? I think, Todd, you and I might have talked about this. There was the example in Austin. People had been talking for a while about we should do restricted services, limited scope services. But once, if you know anything about litigation, if you get into a case and the judge won't let you off the case, you effectively can't do limited scope anymore. So Phil Friday and some other lawyers got together in Austin and they lobbied the judges to create a new local rule to allow for lawyers to say, this is the scope that I'm signing up for. This is what the clients hired me for. You have to let me out of the case once I meet this threshold. And so now in Austin, you can actually file a document that says the client hired me to handle from here to here. When I'm done with this step, I'm going to come and the client's already signed the withdrawal letter, the approval for that. When I come to you, judge, you need to let me off the case. That's a local rule in Austin now. And so I tell that story to say, you are right that lawyers are agile, but they can still deal with constraints. And fixing those constraints will come from the lawyers working together. Todd can't fix these constraints by himself. We're not that agile. We're not that in control. If we want to fix these constraints, we've got to work together.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry. And there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
I kind of think about all the issues that have arisen this year over the bar exam. I think that's kind of a prime example because you've seen when a lot of pushback comes, that's when they started innovating solutions and not universally, of course, but at least it started a conversation that really came, I think, from a groundswell of just frustration, demand, anger from all parts of the bar and all parts of the legal community. And you really did see some pretty speedy results in a unique context.
And amazing the outcry that it required to change something that every piece of data says it doesn't do what it's supposed to do anyway, right? I mean, it literally is not working. And we still had to have this mass movement to change it. Getting back to your point earlier, Jody, the business model is working for the people who are making the decisions. And changing that is going to require a lot of pushback. It's going to require a lot of organization. And so one of the big core pieces in the book is figuring out how to network in a better way, how to create those connected silos of experts. And in it, I make the argument that on a supply chain, if lawyers were not doing everything, which Todd knows most solos, you're literally doing soup to nuts, everything as if we're competent or the most competent person to do all of it on a supply chain, on a legal supply chain. I argue that on that supply chain, there are two roles that are the most profitable. One is deep experts, the people who can do something no one else can do. And two is the connectors, the point of sale, the people who are building audience. And I feel like if we organize in a better way to connect silos of expertise, we'll have influence on changing these rules and these structures, but also we'll deliver better for clients.
Those are interesting concepts in the book. I mean, you talk about the, starts out as sort of the freelancer versus the entrepreneur model, and then you develop it into freelancers really are ideally experts because they can exist and they can practice in a freelance system because no one else can do what they do. And the entrepreneurial model, I mean, you point out that there's a conventional wisdom that solo and small firm practitioners are entrepreneurs, but they're really, for the most part, that isn't true, because entrepreneurs grow things at scale, and law firms are really difficult, particularly solo practices are difficult to grow at scale. I'll be honest, one of the things that I've struggled with in my practice ever since I went out on my own 14 years ago is how to scale it. And my attempts so far have, be honest again, or have failed. It hasn't worked the way that I wanted it to. So you do advocate kind of gravitating toward either one or the other, either becoming expert freelancer or a solopreneur focused on providing accessibility. And I think the definitions, I love the definitions that you come to in some bullet points in the book. You describe freelancers that provide expertise as being folks that make stuff, crafting. You're like forging a sword out of raw steel. Whereas entrepreneurs, in your book, you say they make decisions rather than making stuff. And so as a solo practitioner, I have to think like an entrepreneur because I have to make a lot of decisions. And so I'm struggling, and maybe you can offer me some guidance on this. I'll take a free counseling session. I do consider myself to, as a board certified civil appellate lawyer, to have some expertise, but I struggle with this idea that I have to really drill down on that rather than try and build something that's going to outlast me.
Yeah. And this is a really difficult thing. I was talking to a lady yesterday, or I heard an interview yesterday on a show called Legal Tech Live, and she has created this entrepreneurial business of helping moms collect their child support. And they asked her, are you a lawyer? Are you a tech person? She didn't have any of these competencies. She didn't know how to do any of this stuff, but she was leading this legal tech business. And she pointed out that the reason is because her function is to make decisions. That's not her role. And so it's difficult with the legal atmosphere because we use the term expert and entrepreneur to apply to everyone. And unless those definitions are just so broad as to include everyone, they're just not very helpful. They're not terms that are very useful. And so to make it as tangible as I can, I had a conversation with my friend Megan Zabier, and she was making this decision of what kind of owner she wanted to be. Did she want to be the expert owner, or did she want to be this entrepreneurial solutions engine? And I said to her, if you've got a week, you've just got this random week, would you rather spend that week writing a book or managing people? And she said, writing a book. I would definitely rather be writing a book. I said, there's your answer, right? Because the activities of someone who is an expert, they are different than someone who is an audience-centered solutions engine. Jody, this will resonate for you. I had a conversation with somebody who's a big firm lawyer, and they got in trouble because they weren't answering their email within 10 minutes. And this was somebody who was in the appellate division of this big law firm, who their function is research and writing. Their function is to sit in a room and be a super nerd and tear some ideas apart, come up with new innovative ideas that no one's ever thought of before in the substance of their niche area. And they're supposed to answer emails within 10 minutes. I mean, the switching costs just make no sense. And so the point that I made in the book is that accessibility and expertise, entrepreneurship and expertise, are not compatible. They just fight with each other. They don't work with each other. You see this in big firm context when lawyers are made to do both, but you also see it in the solo small firm context when we're told to do both rather than connecting with other people who can help us with the things we're not good at or we shouldn't be doing. So Todd, my therapy session to you is you might need to let it go. You might at some point, if the function is to live a good life and to have some assets and to do good work, you might have been told a myth that the sign of success for any business owner is to become Uber. That's just a myth. They're not even profitable, as an aside, and won't be for a long, long time. And yet we always cite them as the success model. We're not in that kind of niche. The legal vertical is not like that. There are not billions of potential users. We don't have access to money that we can be millions of dollars in the hole year after year. It's just a totally different context. And so for you, Todd, for you to become somebody who writes and teaches and comes up with amazing ideas and changes, you're more likely to have a statue in the law school than you are to have a three-letter code on the NASDAQ. It's just a different context. So let it go, Todd. Move on, Todd.
It does seem like in our practice area, mine and Jody's practice area specifically, within law firms, within large law firms, you see appellate practice sections, as you point out. And those folks generally will serve a specific role within that law firm. Obviously, they'll handle things that come up within the firm, and they're experts at doing that, but they're also accessible from folks outside the firm to be hired directly. And so in that business model, the day in and day out of their practices is handled by the law firm and all this administrative support that they get in that setting. And so, but the solo doesn't have that. You point out the Clio study in the book where the average solo lawyer is billing like 2 hours a day. And I think your suggestion is that the other 6 hours a day or more that are available are being spent on non-revenue generating activities.
Yeah. And really, I say non-revenue generating, again, because revenue generation is tied to the value of that couple of hours, those look like non-revenue generating activities. The reality is they are necessary activities, right? So when you buy something from Amazon, you are paying for the shoes, but really you're paying for all the support things that go on beyond that, right? So the truth is, a solo, when they're working those other 6 hours and they are working, they're doing things like emotional labor, which are required, that clients expect those and need those. They are part of the value proposition, but they're not paid for because we don't wrap that in our model. If we were doing that consciously, I'd be great with that. But functionally, what we're doing is we're saying we're billing 2 hours when we should either, as it Todd should either be billing 8 hours or 0 hours. If he's the expert, then he should be spending all his time being the super nerd. I say billing, really, you're not billing all that time because you're also doing things like research and writing and the things to become an expert. But again, all revenue generating in an indirect way, you should be either spending 8 hours on that kind of work or zero. You should be the entrepreneurial type that's got a bunch of other people doing that kind of work. Jeff Bezos is not answering the phone, okay? He's not going to pick up the phone and talk to people. He's also not going in and figuring out how the supply chain connects at Amazon. That's not his function. He makes decisions. And so if you want to be that kind of lawyer, great. It's different in the big firm context. I have gotten the response from many a big firm lawyer that, oh, we do this already, right? We specialize, we collaborate, we've got support in the firm. We're not doing the entirety of the supply chain. I just sort of got to call bull on that because every big firm lawyer that I've talked to is like, this sucks. This is not working. This doesn't operate the way we think it does. We're building neither expertise nor brand and audience connection. So we're not delivering on either of these functions. We're commoditized. Again, we're commoditized now. So read the book, take some time, think about it. You might disagree with me, but
I think that's right in the big firm context to an extent. I think the opportunities are there. And the structures are in place to allow for what you said, but I think the practicality and the reality of it is a little bit different. It is a lot easier to cross market between expertise areas because I can walk down the hall and find somebody who knows a lot about something I know nothing about, whatever it might be, and vice versa. But I think you're right, unless you have someone kind of the in-between person that's facilitating those connections and helping make those happen. And frankly, tying it to revenue a little bit, because back to Todd's example, that's all non-billable work. And so it's part of the workday that's not the 6 or 8 hours you need to be billing to do that. And so that's where I think it needs to kind of change in terms of management and compensation.
Right. But that's not a value creation issue. That's a value capture issue. Right? That's a pricing issue. That's not because those other hours of unbillable work is not valuable to the client. We just aren't capturing that value. And in fact, in most cases, and Todd, you know this, in most cases, those other hours are actually more valuable to the client. Those are the hours they actually care about. We tend to get really fixated on those 2 hours of super nerding, but they care a lot more about those other things. And so I do think big firms, they have the resources available to do this well. They just don't, and they don't optimize for it. It requires structural change and a real rethink of what it is that we offer. I think a lot of big firms are talking about the threat of the consultancies. The law firms actually have a lot to learn from the consultancies on how they create new knowledge, how they come up with new ideas, how they capture the value from those new ideas, and how they deliver them well. I think there's a lot to learn there.
So in my practice, the suggestion is I can really drill down deep and become the quintessential Mike Whalen expert and spend most of my time billing rather than administering because I can get help for those things and I can bring in staff that can fulfill those functions and really take that load off of me so that I'm spending more of my waking hours, you know, actually generating revenue, even setting aside the merits of the billable hour versus some other option. But what if I said, no, I want to manage people. So how do I approach using your legal supply chain model? Is my task then to go out and get, just generate as much work as I can, bring it all in, and then find people to dole it out to? Or how does this work?
to explain the solopreneur, I'll tell you about the legal supply chain manager, which is the person that works for that solopreneur and what their functions are. There are four competencies for that person. They are design, source, build, and deliver. Design has to do with clients want whatever. Let me come up with ideas for serving those needs. Source has to do with making sure the best people are doing the right pieces of those things. Build is about quality control, and deliver is about customer experience. What the solopreneur does is think about those four things and try to build on those four things. Their function is to coordinate the silos to deliver better for clients. So you've got a bunch of siloed nerds, right? Super nerds out there doing great at what they do. But if Todd is spending most of his time trying to find appellate cases, then Todd is not doing what Todd is best at, right? Todd should be doing different work, but you are not going to do it, my friend Todd, unless you know that someone is out there trying to connect you to the work. You can't survive unless there are systems in place where you can connect to the work. A very simple way to do it that I make reference to in the book is there's a company called Law Clerk, and you can go on there and you can hire people. You can be hired by people. It's a great way to network. But in general, what you need are those sort of platforms and organizers. You need people who are getting together to do these individual cases, but you need somebody to play that coordination role. If you want to be the solopreneur, that's your function. Your function is to do the work that is required by that connection. The clients will tell you what it is that they need. Your core competency is project management, right? That doesn't sound sexy. It doesn't sound cool, but your core function is execution. It's not expertise. The experts will go do the innovation threshold required for the industry, but your function is execution. And so in the same way that Todd is going to go become a super nerd about what he does, your job is to become a super nerd about project management, about marketing, about coming up with solutions and design functions. If you want to be that person, great, but stop calling yourself an entrepreneur if you're not doing those things, because you're just not. You're just a business owner, which is fine, but you're not an entrepreneur.
I've always thought the difficulty in filling that role would be accepting, you know, taking a step back from actually being a lawyer, because we all went to law school, I think ideally at least, to be lawyers. But you're talking about really a CEO kind of role. And even project management is really more accurate, because CEO is even a little different role than that.
Just as an aside, go see a therapist.
That's twice today we've talked about therapy for me.
You do need to make that shift.
I think all lawyers could probably use that advice.
Seriously. Yeah, it is tough to let go of that stuff. And I understand that. I have friends. I'll give you the example of Jim Hacking, for example. He's running a pretty solopreneurish firm. He still keeps his toe in the practice, and he takes cases that matter to him. His associates will go do the work that makes the money and keeps the firm going, but he gets to go do cause lawyering for a couple of hours a day. Sort of risky, and there's research in doctors that shows that keeping your toe in the practice might undermine your long-term skills if you're just sort of dabbling in it. But you do have that capacity. You have the ability to take some of these passion cases so you can stay in the practice of law, but that's not your primary function.
So my next question then, a follow-up on that, is let's say in Texas, somebody adopted that model. You know, let's say I did. I'm become a project manager for my firm. I've got the talent lined up, the experts. Heck, I can get experts in any number of subjects that would benefit trial lawyers and fit my practice area, like trial support, error preservation, jury charges, summary judgment motions, appeals to specific courts or supersedious issues, just to list off the ones that come to mind. But I think the biggest constraint to following that model is the ethics rule that says you can pay somebody as a contractor what they have charged you, but you can't upcharge their fee. And so someone's going to have to crack the nut of how to turn this into a profitable enterprise without being in violation of the ethics rules. And I'll submit that that rule it's not even in the rule specifically. It's an ethics opinion. And I don't mind saying that I think it's incorrect, that the analysis in that ethics opinion is wrong, and it wrongly hinders solo and small firm practitioners from being able to make money and serve their clients better. But that opinion aside, I haven't quite figured out how to crack that nut and stay on the right side of the ethics line.
Yeah, and I think, and this is going to be a bit of an unpopular opinion, if you are a solopreneur, if you're that type of person, part of your function is to push up against constraints, to figure out where your constraints are and push back on them. That's just part of the function. And so a lot of people will tell me I can't do solopreneur-y things because I've got this constraint. And that's true. But Walmart has the constraint of physical space, right? Restaurants have the constraint of labor laws that make it so they can only work so many hours. Every business has constraints. And so what I see with lawyers a lot with ethics things is they'll stay way afield of some potential violation. They're so afraid of some potential violation that they'll stay so far away from it. They never actually dig in and learn the rules. They never actually go figure out what my constraints really are and how can I creatively push against them. And they never figure out how to do lobbying, right? How to go push back on these things and push changes in the rules. That's what Phil Friday did that I mentioned in Austin. You are right that that is a potential constraint. My answer to you on that specific thing is that's your job. If you want to be that person, go figure it out. Right? Go push back against it. And if it ends up being a constraint that you can't break, then you turn your business in another direction, right? That's what all of these, you saw GE who went from whatever it was they did early to making these light, but you see a lot of switches. Procter & Gamble really switched what their business model was early. You see a lot of changing of business models. When you're an entrepreneur, you have to be willing to let go of your early years if they don't work. If the constraints just get too heavy and you see a better opportunity, go do something else. Again, like you said, emotionally, that's really difficult for lawyers, but that's the work.
It's the proverbial pivot.
Well, it is. And it brings, I think, back to your point earlier, it's good to continue having these conversations, I think, as a profession about some of these constraints and whether they make sense in the current environment and constantly revisiting those, because the answer can't always be, well, this is the way the rules always been, because the rules have to be adaptable to the practice of law as well within the bounds of ethics. Because as the practice of law changes, sometimes the rules have to change too.
And Todd, if you're a community organizer, if that's part of the function of being an entrepreneur, and it is, then you can be the host. You can be the person who goes and creates that tension, that movement. You can use storytelling and persuasion to turn that tension that everybody like you feels. Everybody is annoyed by this ridiculous ethics opinion. And you know that that energy is there, but somebody's got to go organize that energy. Somebody's got to create the tension that will make change. Right now, it's just a bunch of lawyers sitting in their fancy offices griping about it. And it's never going to change if that's what we do.
That's a great point, Mike. And it's difficult to be the one that's out there pushing against the constraints sometimes, but sometimes it seems like that's just what our industry needs so that we learn to think differently and attack problems differently. So,
and thankfully, you were trained to do just that, right? The number of lawyers that I see sitting around complaining about bar associations is fascinating to me, as if it's not the Bible, people, okay? This is not the immutable word of God, right? These are rules created by humans who were trying to do the best with what they understood of the problem. You can go create some advocacy. You are trained in that. Go do that work.
Well, times do change. And yeah, I think for those who complain about bar associations, I'm a bar nerd myself, and I would invite them to participate, get involved, and don't just rant on Facebook about how the bar is out to get you. As a short personal aside before we wrap up, I'll mention that Mike was, I think, the only law student, because of his forming of the Future Solos group, who would actually come and participate in Austin Bar Solo and Small Firm Section activities when he was a 2L at UT. And that's how we got to know each other, because I was involved in that section. I was actually chair of that section for a time. And so of being proactive, going out and networking, you mentioned changes in the approach to networking, doing things that were not traditional. I mean, law students just didn't do this. And we're still all these years later really trying to recruit future members to the bar from the law student body. But that was a fascinating time. And I was glad certainly to get to know you and when you were in that role. And it's been a pleasure to stay in touch with you and follow you up to this point.
I appreciate that. Most of the good ideas that I've had, it's because I was too stupid to know you weren't supposed to do it that way. Stay ignorant, kids. That's the lesson.
The true driver of innovation, ignorance.
It seems like, though, hearing these conversations and kind of following what's going on, it seems like we're at a time where if there's ever been sort of a groundswell for a lot of significant change, it's right now, because everyone in the legal community in every state has had to revisit the way that they practice law in the last 6 months. And it makes a lot of opportunities to really revisit some of these things and say, well, we've always done it that way, but look at how all these other things have worked. And hey, let's talk about how we can incorporate some of that going forward.
Whether you're in a big firm or in a small firm community, build social capital and use that social capital to create change.
Well, that's a perfect ending point, I think. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll mention the book one more time, Lawyer Forward. It's available on Amazon. It's full of good stories. You've heard some of them on the show today. I highly encourage everyone to read it. It will make you think about your practice and your role in it, your role in the legal system.
Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@texapplawpod.com, message us on Twitter or Instagram @texapplawpod, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter @texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.